Geekville Radio.
Hello, citizens of Geekville, ladies and gentlemen, geeks and geekettes. This is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville, and the host of Geekville Radio, coming at you with another episode here. This is episode number 356, and we'll lead it off here with just kind of more of a discussion. But right now, it's just me just thought I'd chat with y'all about some geek topics, because the news has been pretty light this past. A lot of focus had been on WrestleMania, so I think that's really is where my focus had been. So the news just wasn't as quite interesting to wade through. So rather than try to go through a couple news things, I think I'd just like to chat with y'all a little bit about one of the geek topics that comes up every now and then, and that is Superman and being invulnerable and such. Because if you go through the lore, we get told that Superman is effectively invulnerable. Now, he does have weaknesses. We'll get into that in a second. But the other thing in geek lore, if you go into the Star Wars world, is that we're told that a lightsaber can cut through anything. And there's been jokes over the years, you know, lightsabers falling through the floor or something, but that poses the question. A lightsaber can cut through anything, but yet Superman is invulnerable physically. So let's dive into this. Now, the short answer, if you're just looking for a quick answer, would a lightsaber, say, chop off Superman's arm? No. I wholeheartedly believe that would be a no on that. No. The big question is, could a lightsaber actually hurt Superman? And that, I think, is yes. Now, if you were to swing it, it wouldn't cut through him. I think with the way the blades work, because the blade is supposed to kind of act like a solid matter, but yet Superman would be so dense and so his skin would just be so tough, his body would be so tough, that it would kind of act more like, well, chopping a cement block or something like that, solid cement or solid steel. Probably an anvil is probably a better example. It'd be like trying to use an axe on an anvil. So what are the variations on this? What could we have on this? Because one of the big things that I use when talking about the strength of a lightsaber, and anybody that has spent any time gaming classic tabletop dice style, you've probably had these discussions that yes, a lightsaber could cut through anything, just not necessarily like the warm knife through butter, that the stronger the material, the harder it might be for a lightsaber to cut through. Now, there's a whole other discussion we could get into, especially in the old school Star Wars gaming books that were put out by West End Games way back when it was all six-sided dice, was that the more powerful the Jedi, the more powerful the lightsaber swing. So thus, peak Luke Skywalker or Darth Vader would be able to slash through something much more easily than a run-of-the-mill Jedi or an entry-level Jedi, stuff like that. I kind of equate it to the samurai or the swordsman expert that is able just to do a quick cut through something where it doesn't even look like he hits it, but then you see the material just slide off in half. I think that's kind of what that can be compared to when it comes to Jedi swinging lightsabers. But I would always argue, again, the harder the metal or the harder the material, harder the armor, the harder it is for that saber to go through, no matter who's wielding it. Simple wood or regular walls, unarmored metal walls, say, stuff like that. Something that you might see in the back of a cargo van or cargo speeder. Lightsaber's probably going to cut through that with little difficulty. But when we're talking walkers, armored vehicles and such, because there were people that used to argue, well, my lightsaber can cut through anything. Why can't I just lop off the legs of an AT-AT walker? Well, if a lightsaber could actually do that, that's what Luke probably would have been doing during the Hoth battle in Empire Strikes Back. But instead, he has to rappel up and toss a thermal detonator inside said AT-AT. Now, he's able to chop the door open, or the trap door or gate or whatever you want to call it underneath. He's able to open up a hole large enough to stick a small object through, but that would hardly be critical damage just in that own right, where the true damage was caused from the thermal detonator and whatever it blew up inside of the AT-AT. Honestly, that was just made to give the heroes a glimmer of hope, I think, in the supposedly unwinnable battle. But let's fast forward, or depending on when you saw the when in your life you saw the movies, flash back a little bit. A perfect example of this with lightsabers and harder material is the opening action sequence in Episode 1, The Phantom Menace. Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan whack through battle droids pretty easily. That's quite obvious. A battle droid clearly made of metal, clearly is no match against a lightsaber. But what happens when the Trade Federation close the blast doors? You get those heavy, shielded, armored, whatever doors. Those close up, and you notice Qui-Gon is still able to cut through it. It just takes him a while. He has to do it kind of more like a drill, and that would take a long time for him to cut a hole big enough to walk through. He could have eventually done it, but they were chased off by the droidicas, and that brings in a whole other conversation that we'll do another day about the Force speed and why didn't Obi-Wan do it later in Phantom Menace, because I do have an answer for that. So more to come on that in another episode. But that, I think, is evidence to show that just simply swinging a lightsaber against Superman wouldn't cause much damage. At most, you might, well, you'd probably nick the suit or something, but I don't think Superman might even feel pain from something like that, even though it's got that intense energy. Another thing Superman has going for him, and this is kind of a caveat when it comes to wherever this battle is taking place, Superman gets his power from the sun, from Earth's yellow sun. That is why he is so powerful. Krypton was a red sun, so Kryptonians did not have superpowers on Krypton. They just were effectively humans. So if we're on Earth doing this and somebody slashes a lightsaber at Superman, probably not going to do much. If you were to somehow incapacitate Superman to the point where you could just stick him or just try jamming that lightsaber in, I think eventually it might actually do some damage. And yes, it probably would cause him some pain there. But that's the big question of how the hell do you tie up or compromise Superman long enough that you could do this? It's not like you can just tie him up or anything like that. So now that we've established under Earth conditions, a lightsaber's pretty useless against Superman, let's change the deck a little bit, and we can change locations, because for those that may not be an expert on Superman, if you've only seen the movies or the TV shows and such, you may not know that Superman has two, possibly three weaknesses, depending on how you look at it. Obviously, everybody knows of the major weakness, kryptonite. Those two other weaknesses that don't really get played out on anything other than the comics are the aforementioned red sun energy, if you want to call that a weakness. If you could put him under a red sun, that would effectively turn him human. It wouldn't kill him, but it would turn him human, and thus he'd be vulnerable to injuries and death that ordinary humans are vulnerable to. The third weakness that many people don't know about outside of comic readers is magic. Superman is vulnerable to magic. It won't kill him nearly as quickly or as easily as kryptonite could, but it is a faster way to make him say ow. So conceivably, if you want to look at the Force as magic, then potentially some dark side powers, and obviously I'm not talking about DC's dark side, I'm talking about the dark side of the Force, conceivably that could be used to weaken Superman. I think the argument is there that he might be vulnerable to Force lightning. That would also theoretically mean some of the life siphoning and such that we see Palpatine do at the end of Rise of Skywalker. Something like that could work. If there is a way to enhance said lightsaber with the dark side of the Force, it brings us to a possible maybe. Anybody who knows the inner workings of a lightsaber knows that it is a crystal inside the lightsaber that when fused with energy gives off that light. People have proposed, well, what if you put kryptonite in the lightsaber to shoot the beam through? That is potentially a wild goose chase. That'd be the best way to describe it, but that might not be such a cut and dry idea because kryptonite is its own thing. Lightsabers traditionally have been powered by kyber crystal. The type of crystal is called kyber, and it goes around back to the 70s, even in the days of Splinter of the Mind's Eye, the original sequel to Star Wars that Lucas wrote before Empire Strikes Back came around. Also, in modern lore, Disney and post-Disney lore, kyber crystals were also used for the Death Star super laser to blow up planets. So yes, that theoretically could mean that the super laser from the Death Star is effectively a really, 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 really big lightsaber blade. So after all that tangent and song and dance, what I'm getting at is kryptonite is not a kyber crystal, at least theoretically in the geek world it isn't. So we don't know what would happen if you put kryptonite in a lightsaber. I personally don't think that would work. I think it would shatter the crystal. Something else very bad would happen. It would probably kill the person that tried to use it. So in my opinion, we can rule out a kryptonite-powered lightsaber, but we could conceivably still have other force powers. Now, I mentioned the Red Sun energy before. That could weaken him. And certainly there could be the argument of something happening in outer space or just someplace out of the way from a yellow sun. Because you take Superman out of a yellow sun environment and not into a red sun environment, he's like a solar battery. Eventually, he would weaken. May take a while, but it eventually would happen. This is why you may have seen Superman, especially in the comics, fly out into space and just get really close to the sun. Because then he can recover any energy he's lost, possibly even beef himself up some, and then he's good to go. So to wrap this up, quick review. A standard lightsaber against Superman on Earth would be pretty useless. A lightsaber somehow paired with a red sun environment, whether it's a planet with a red sun or in some place inside that can simulate red sun energy, because that has been done in the comics before. I think it was even done in the Justice League animated series. If you put him under a red sun, he's probably going to be toast against a lightsaber. And he could be vulnerable potentially to things like force lightning, possibly even force choke, because of his vulnerability to magic, if you want to believe that the force is a form of magic. And I think there is an argument for that. So I hope that gives you some interesting discussions in the future when it comes to stuff like that. It's not quite so cut and dry. But of course, I'd like to know what you, the Geekle Radio listener, would think about this. You can hit us up on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram on the social medias. You can go to geekleradio.com and reply to posts right there. I am curious to hear what your take would be on that. So that's going to wrap up this little geek subject discussion here. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will go to the obligatory reviews of The Bad Batch and Episode 5 of X-Men 97. This is Geekle Radio, and we will be right back.
Coming soon to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and your favorite podcasting devices around the world. Hello, this is Seth, a.k.a. Xandrax, the mayor of Geekville, and the host of Geekville Radio, and I'm happy to announce the latest addition to the Geekville Radio podcast channels. We do have Geekville Radio, which covers all aspects of geekery, TVs, movies, superheroes, science fiction, you name it. We have Examining the Doctor, which is our Doctor Who-themed podcast, and we have Examining the Dead, which is our horror-themed podcast. Well, the latest addition to those Geekle Radio channels is called the Lesser Known Geek Hall of Fame. And I know some people may say that Lesser Known and Hall of Fame may be an oxymoron, and that is, quite frankly, true. But here at Geekle Radio, we like to pay tribute to some of the lesser known characters out there. We're not going to talk much about Superman or Spider-Man or Wonder Woman or any of the other A-listers. We're going to talk about characters that might not be the first names that roll off your tongue when it comes to characters, both heroes and villains, but characters who the story of heroes and villains might not be complete without. And fortunately, I don't have to do it alone. Joining me on this journey, and we will have other guests along the way, my usual co-host for Geekle Radio, from a soft padded cell in South Kakalaki, Crazy Train Jonathan Bullitt.
All aboard, ladies and gentlemen. That's right, we're going to go back in the annals of history and pull out some of those lesser-known geek heroes and villains. Some of the people you might not have heard of or only know a little bit about, some that are near and dear to our heart, and some that we don't know that much, so we're going to enjoy just doing the research ourselves. Dropping soon, we're going to start with our inaugural podcast on one of my all-time favorite characters, The Shadow. That's the kind of things you'll be looking at on the Lesser-Known Geek Hall of Fame.
Once again, that is the Lesser Known Geek Hall of Fame, the latest channel at Geekville Radio, available at geekvilleradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or the podcasting device of your choice.
All right, we are back talking The Bad Batch. Now, some people may call this episode a filler show, and I certainly wouldn't argue against that because, after all, the heroes didn't know anything more than they did at the beginning of the episode. They knew that Mount Tantus is out there, but didn't know how to get there. And then they spend the whole episode on a heist, and then they find out, well, nobody knows how to get there. So that was the downside. But like I said, if you're going to have a filler episode, this is how you do it, because there was a lot of the swashbuckling action that you'd expect from a Star Wars story. It's got some character development to boot. So I actually liked this episode a lot. Seems like I liked it more than a lot of other people. And it did genuinely feel like Star Wars, even in the beginning when Clone X, or whatever his official name is brings Omega to Mount Tantus. It was reminiscent of Krennic visiting Vader on Mustafar in Rogue One, or really just about any scene involving an evil enemy base or castle. I think we even saw a little bit of that in the Obi-Wan series as well. But the main plot of the episode is the Clone Force 99 decide to bust Rampart, Admiral Rampart, out of an Imperial prison because Crosshair believed that Rampart might know the location of Mount Tantus. Now, if you don't recall offhand, Admiral Rampart was the main antagonist. He was the central bad guy in the first season of Bad Batch, and he was the guy that authorized the destruction of Kamino. Now, we all know they did that, so there wouldn't be any other cloning facilities other than what the Emperor would have access to. So that was the idea. Maybe he was high-ranking in the Empire. He might know the location, because it makes sense that he might have access to that type of stuff, because he, like I said, he authorized the destruction of Kamino, but then through political maneuverings, Palpatine basically threw him under the walker, because they don't think they have buses in Star Wars. It's a walker. He threw him under the walker. But this heist episode was, the action was pretty much the entire second and third act. The heroes endeared the Juggernaut transport, like I think we first saw those, and I want to say Revenge of the Sith. They even do a game of chicken on a bridge with another Juggernaut, and they do a jump over it, Dukes of Hazzard style. It's probably my favorite part. And then, of course, it went right from Dukes of Hazzard to Back to the Future 3 when it plunges off the edge of the mountain. And they did leave us with a cliffhanger, because Rampart says that nobody knows where Tantus is, but he might be able to find a way around that. Just kind of like the tease we got at the beginning of the episode. They didn't reveal what that was, but my hunch is this is going to be something else that might connect back to the first season and what was going on then. It's possible Tarkin might know where Tantus is. I'm just throwing that out there, because Tarkin, they did bring him back for a cameo a week or two ago. So if I were a betting man and I had to pick where I think they're going, I think it's going to bring Tarkin into it in some capacity. Now, obviously, Tarkin's not going to go along with Rampart. It's not going to be a formal discussion. It might involve stealing or sneaking into or hacking Tarkin's records. I could be way off base with that, but I think that's a good of a guess as anybody. But I do have to ask, how many more episodes before the heroes make it to Tantus? I don't think we have that many episodes left. And like other people have pointed out in their reviews, it took them, what, 3 episodes to find out what M count was, and now we're on about our 3rd episode trying to find where Tantus is. So hopefully they can get that wound up pretty soon, because it's not making our heroes look very smart that they basically spent the last 5 episodes just looking for answers. I'm still enjoying the season, though, so I'm definitely looking forward to the next episode, because I'm assuming what we're going to get is more of Omega interacting with the children test subjects, these Force-sensitive children that are being used for eventually being the somehow in how Palpatine returned. I overall would give this episode about an A-. Like I said, I liked it a lot, probably liked it more than other people. You give me a good action sequence, it's hard for me to not like something. So we will switch universes again, and we'll wind up here talking X-Men 97, episode 5. This episode was called Remember It. And holy cow, there's a lot to process with this one. The major points of this are that Gambit is dead, at least temporarily, and it's not a realm of unconsciousness or just knocked out or anything like that. He's dead because Rogue is physically touching him, and if he was alive, she'd be able to access him, so to speak. She'd be able to get his powers. So, yeah, he is dead. They're also hinting Magneto, Nightcrawler, Leech, and many of the other Morlocks, along with Sebastian Shaw and White Queen. They're hinting they're dead as well. We all know nobody stays dead in comics, so we're probably going to get their return by the time the season is over. This episode mainly took place on Genosha, and it's a sight to behold seeing what Genosha had become. Because when we first saw Genosha in the original run of the series, it was just kind of a land of outcasts. I kind of compare it to New York in the Kurt Russell, James Cameron film Escape from New York. It's just nobody goes there. But much like Nevarro in The Mandalorian, the place has become a much more of a thriving community. There's definitely a lot of happy people there. They have their leaders. They have their grand ball, so to speak. All the fancy people in their fancy clothes dancing around. And of all things to dance around to, they're dancing to Ace of Base. You know, they're going to dance to Ace of Base. You think they would have at least used the sign or something like that, a song people know. But we got a giant monster of a sentinel, literally. I think it was referred to as a Godzilla sentinel. And it lays to waste many of the heroes, many of the mutants, all the buildings. Apparently buries Magneto, Nightcrawler, and a lot of the other heroes. And just a lot of visions being thrown about. We're still trying to figure out which visions are Madeline's, which ones are Jean's, and really who's dead and who's not. I'm definitely in the camp that Magneto is not dead. He might be missing for a while, but he's not dead, and Gambit's too popular to stay dead. We all know nobody stays dead in comics except for, you know, Uncle Ben. I used to say nobody stays dead in comics except for the Punisher's family, but, well, not even going to get into that. That's other comic talk. We're sticking with X-Men. I would give this one a B-. This was a tripped-out episode as expected. There's a lot to process, but just the sheer number of apparent deaths it's pretty substantial. And it looks like it's Splitsville for Cyclops and Jean Grey, because Cyclops can't seem to make up his mind. And there's two main questions that I can ask from here. One is, surely they didn't kill off half the mutant roster, did they? Follow the mutant style? And how would the rest of the world cope with this massacre? Because there was a news documentary being filmed at the time of this happening. So a lot of that's probably going to get out to the rest of the world. A lot of people are going to see that. So how would the normal humans react? I would think it's very possible that it would, if anything, make people sympathetic to the mutants' cause. Because here are these giant weapons of death coming in and just pounding them into oblivion, and they can barely defend themselves. Now, I'm not saying it's going to make humans rally or like physically take up arms, because I think they'd be intimidated by the firepower of the enemy. But I think it would at least gain more support. You know, you kind of look at it as an evil empire thing. You know, you wipe out a bunch of innocent civilians, and the rest of the world's going to take note of that, even if they're not able to take up arms and physically defend. So hopefully that'll be what'll happen. Mutants might be painted in a much better light. I think we are getting Magneto back. Nightcrawler maybe could have bamfed away at the last second. And even some of the less likable characters like Sebastian and Emma Frost, I doubt they'd kill them off after such brief cameos here. So definitely like to know what you folks think. This has been Geekville Radio. If you like what you hear, definitely drop us a line, give us a like, give us a review. We're all over the Podsphere, the podcast format of your choosing. You can find us at geekvilleradio.com. Social media is on Facebook, X/Twitter, or Instagram at Geekville Radio, 2 words. Let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like. If you give us a review, the only thing I ask is be honest. Even if you're going to say something negative, you think we suck, just be honest with what you say, because I'm always looking for ways to improve the show, make you, the listener, happy. So I welcome any and all feedback. So until next time, we are going to power down the Geekville Radio studios, and we'll call it a night. We'll be back soon with episode 357. Not a magnum or anything like that, but We'll have some fun discussion then. So thanks for listening, and good night.
Geekville Radio is not sponsored or endorsed by any products or services unless specifically stated. The views expressed by the hosts and or guests do not reflect the views of GeekvilleRadio.com, the Wrestling Brethren podcast, family, or any of their affiliates. Some media used in Geekville Radio is the product of their respective copyright holders, all rights reserved.